Take two, coming to you live from the Good Earth Coffee House at Glenmore Landing. Beautiful spot if you've never checked it out. And they did not pay me to say that. I'm just a big fan.
I agree.
What is your favorite coffee house in Calgary? Do you have one?
I really like Neighbor Coffee. Neighbor Coffee's delicious, but I think Philosophy is one of my absolute favorites on 17th there.
Philosophy. Oh, I've been there once, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Interesting. Yep. Do you have a fit? Are you a big coffee drinker?
I really like good coffee. Like, yeah. If I'm going to put coffee in my body, it's going to be good coffee.
It's going to be good. How do you determine if it's good? Like, what are your, like...
I really like dark roast, so yeah. I like a good, like... powerful, chocolatey, rich, dark roast.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. I dig it. And do you put anything in your coffee?
Typically, no. I usually like either black, and that's also, if it's good coffee, then you can drink it black.
Yes.
It doesn't, you know, corrode your system. but I also really like espresso, too.
Okay.
Espresso is usually my go-to.
Okay. There you go. There you go. Did you ever work in a coffee bar or anything?
I worked at Teavana.
Teavana?
Yeah.
What's that?
That was in Chinook Mall, and it was purchased by Starbucks. And before that, I'm trying to remember what the heck it was.
So that one kind of by, like, the escalators in the middle?
Yeah, okay. It was that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I worked there, and then I also worked at David's Tea for, like, 5 years.
And are they done? Done?
No.
No?
No, they're still around.
They're still kicking. Okay.
Yeah.
But they closed a bunch of retail spots.
Yeah, I left, I think, a year after they went public, and then they changed a lot of, like, their recipes and stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So were you, like, a tea maker?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved making tea. I still love tea. And that's actually how my partner and I met.
Tea making workshop?
No. He came into David's Tea pretty much every day to see me, of course. Over time we just started developing a friendship, and eventually after the third batch of cookies I baked for him, he finally asked me out. So
what kind of cookies are we talking? Were they different every time?
Or? They were different every time. So I started with, like, you know, the regular chocolate chip, get a good base there.
Yeah.
And then I think I made him, like, a lime cookie or something, because he loved key lime pie, so I turned it into a cookie. And finally, I baked him macarons, which, if you've ever tried to bake, they are a little bit of a finicky cookie.
I have not.
Yeah, they're very finicky. Yeah. It requires, like, a lot of elevation, accounting for that and stuff.
Love
egg white
story
powder,
as old as time right
meringue
there.
Powder, yeah.
Awesome. Well, Amy Thompson.
Yes.
Welcome to Coffee Chats with Seth. We were talking before. I had labeled these summer coffee chats, and you'd reached out early in the summer, and it is now, we are in the final days.
We are.
So I don't know what I'm going to do, if we're going to keep doing coffee chats and I got to rebrand them. But anyway, we snuck this in right under the wire. So why don't we dive into a little bit about what you do? You were telling me a little bit the first take, but let's try again.
So I work for the Alberta Council for Environmental Education. And basically our mission, vision, values is to make sure that all Albertans have the tools they need to understand kind of the scope of environmental education and climate change, climate action, and really what they can do in their daily lives to help reduce their impact on the planet.
Very interesting topic. Can be a very controversial topic at times.
Yep.
I have two kids. They are... my daughter's birthday is Friday. She's going to be 7. And my son, he's turning 12 here in the fall. What kind of world do you think they're going to be living in, you know, 10, 15 years from now? And I guess what's the messaging to those school-age kids? You know, when I think back to being in school, it's more like brush your teeth and, like, do your homework and go to bed. There wasn't a whole lot of talk of climate change that I recall. But, like, what are some things that, you know, through your program and work that you're teaching those kids to, you know, maybe be their best habits heading forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the scope of what students are facing today and youth are facing today is completely different from what we faced when we went to school and when we were kids. And in, I guess in some ways it's not, but in more ways it is. They've gone through more global events than we did growing up, and we've been through quite a few as well, but in their short lives, they really have been through a global pandemic. They've been through many recessions, which is wild.
Feels like it's just been an ongoing recession since like 2008.
Yeah, pretty much since the first one, and it's just kind of rolled into the next one.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of emotional uncertainty for sure with kids. And I think that one of the biggest hurdles educators face is actually climate anxiety.
Yeah.
And kind of worrying about like, what do kids do? Like how do we face this? So that's one of the things that we actually work towards and try and approach climate action with a sense of hope versus a sense of dread. Mainly because when you're approaching systems change through that sense of hope, you're going to have less of a burnout.
Mm.
So if you're facing things with a sense of doom and gloom of like, oh, if we don't do this, then this is going to happen, that's really stressful.
Yeah.
So we try and communicate that and then work with organizations all across Alberta with the same kind of mindset. Because also, if you're approaching teaching something from the set of that kind of negative mindset, you're also going to kind of turn people off mm-hmm. from the get-go, right? Because you don't want to work with something that's going to make you feel bad.
Yeah.
And just like anything else in our lives, those bad memories usually stick with us more than the good just because they have such a strong impact. So when it comes to kind of approaching the climate conversation with kids, I like to approach it more with a relationship first lens, which with my graduate work and my work with reconciliation is also a really great model to follow, because then you're starting with good relationships first and then figuring out what works for both parties to really come to a strong relationship, which is kind of cool.
Interesting. And I mean, it's easy to get sucked down the rabbit hole of the divisiveness of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to be an optimist at the, you know, the majority of the time. What do you estimate there is to be hopeful for on the horizon
mm-hmm.
when it comes to the climate?
I think there's a lot of room for innovation. We're learning more than we ever have, really, about the structures of plants, the relationships of animals to the earth, and we're doing a lot of really awesome work with reconciliation too. So if we develop those relationships and that understanding, there's a lot of room there for understanding how to move forward using the tools of the past or the tools that already exist on our planet. For instance, there's, I think, a biotech lab in MIT that's working on really cool stuff like biomimicry, using the systems and the structures of plants to make climate change and do things like... Actually, I just got back from the Yukon at the beginning of the month. No, oh my gosh, that was August already. That's wild.
Time flies.
Yeah, truly. I was in the Yukon from July 30th into August 10th.
Okay.
And one of the places we visited was the Yukon University, or UU, which is just fun to say.
Because the YU?
Yeah.
Okay.
UU.
Okay, yeah.
But they're doing really cool things with climate education and climate research. For instance, there's an invasive species, which I believe is white sweet clover or white... Actually, I think I wrote it down. But they're basically using how that invasive species is damaging to other plants by taking nutrient sources to work with tailing ponds to remove the nitrogen from the tailing ponds. So they're basically making like a super stew, if you will.
Interesting.
To remove the nitrogen so that the tailing pond can be viable again.
With the invasive species.
Basically,
the invasive species came in and they're like, we're going to put you to work doing something useful.
Yep. White clover, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. How do you learn that? Like, where does that...
Right?
Like,
it's so cool. I think it was basically the scientists were looking at ways to remove nitrogen using a whole suite of natural plants.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried a whole bunch of different ones. They tried, like, fish bones as well because they're really high in nitrogen. They tried... what else? They tried, I think, a couple of other different plants. Like straws and different types of like wheat and grasses and stuff, but they just weren't as effective. And then they actually noticed that the white clover was growing around all the tailing ponds. So they said, like, well, why not try this? It's already an invasive species. What's the worst that could happen?
Right. That's fascinating.
I know. It was really cool.
So all that back to your original point, which is lots of room for innovation.
Yeah. So much room for innovation. And I think that youth are so smart and so gung-ho that there's a lot of room for them to innovate in different ways than we'd ever thought. Like, every career can become a green career if you just apply the right approach, or if you kind of apply a different way of thinking to the problems you're trying to solve.
Yeah. And hopefully somebody listening to this right now or in the world is going to come up with a better solution to paper straws through some type of innovation.
I know, because like straws are still necessary for a lot of folks that I think are often left out of the conversation in terms of accessibility. But I do agree that they're, you know, paper straws, they melt in your drink, they just dissolve. There's got to be a better way. I personally like licorice straws myself.
That is a solid substitute.
Yep, good licorice straw.
Maybe just that.
The one downside being is they do have gluten in them. And I am sadly gluten intolerant, I can't eat it, but still.
I was watching something the other day around gluten intolerance and why there's been such a surge of it in the last, call it, 20 years. Because, I mean, when we were growing up, that's not something that existed, really.
Yeah.
Or at least wasn't in the common...
Totally.
Right? It was something to do with, like, the way the crops are grown and all the chemicals that are used that has sort of created what exists now. I didn't deep dive the credibility of the report of the whatever, but it was an interesting perspective that how crops are grown now is different than it was, and therefore it's created these conditions that never existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of actually goes back to a lot of the same kind of things that people say when they don't agree with climate change, actually, is just because we have more data doesn't mean it wasn't a problem that existed before. Because we have more people self-reporting, we have more data that we have collected, and we have been aware of things that are an issue. So there is more data.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it didn't exist before.
Right. Like, it could be a lot of people were just dealing with it, and there was... Yeah, I agree that's probably part of it. I just wonder if there is something different in the food we eat that is contributing, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and a lot of times it's actually preservatives that we use that people have sensitivities to, not actually the food themselves.
Right.
For instance, even though I'm gluten intolerant, I can eat sourdough because it's been fermented. So it's a different process in terms of how it's broken down and like how the enzymes work. So it's very, very interesting.
It can get very technical.
Oh, yeah, it's wild. It's been quite a journey of self-discovery with my gut over the past couple years.
There you go. How did you get into this specific line of work? Like, what was climate, et cetera, something you've been passionate about for a while, or did you just kind of stumble into it? How'd that happen?
Yeah, definitely always been passionate about climate action and the environment, but it's been an interesting journey in terms of my career to get here. I actually started as a archaeologist, so I went to school for archaeology.
Interesting.
And I worked 3 summers at the Blackfoot Crossing Historical Park at the Clooney site.
What's that?
So the Clooney Fortified Village site is actually pretty cool. It's the only site in Alberta that's been found where it's a fortified village, which basically means that it's got a fence around the entire village, and it's actually been like essentially enclosed, which is not typical for Blackfoot cultures.
Interesting. So, like, you know, I'm just thinking of a moat now, but like basically they more or less they protected this
yeah.
settlement.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So like it's really cool because you can see it from an aerial perspective, so from aerial photography, and you can see like it's basically like a C kind of shape like that.
Okay.
So you can basically have like the ditch where it would have been dug remaining, and then you have 13 kind of little posts going around here that we found.
Is there a significance to the number 13, or that's just the perimeter?
There usually is a significance to the number 13, actually, in a lot of Indigenous cultures, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know. Maybe it could have just been 13
yeah.
for the sake of 13, or it could have been there because it was significant to their culture.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And just for the folks listening, I'm getting the full drawing here, play-by-play, of the aerial view right now.
Yeah, it's kind of like a...
like a half moon or like a three-quarter moon-ish?
Yeah, it's like a C, kind of like a backwards C. It's very interesting.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically the University of Calgary has been excavating this spot on and off for the past 30 years.
Interesting.
Working with the Siksika Nation to uncover their own history, which is pretty fantastic.
And so in the three summers you were there, what were you just like kind of going through stuff that got excavated? Were you out there with like a little brush trying to...
I was, yeah. Okay. So basically it's really cool. And this does relate to my where I am now. But basically the first summer I was working as a student and basically training in archaeological techniques. And then the following two summers I was actually working and hired by the University of Calgary. So the second summer I was working with the public archaeology program, which of course is folks will come down since it's a heritage site. It's just a kilometer or two from where Treaty 7 was signed.
Mm-hmm.
And you of course have people who are curious about the site and what's happening and kind of what exists in that space.
Yeah.
So my job was to help with students as well who were working and learning how to do the archaeology thing, but then also give that public education. Which is really where I got the education bug. So that was kind of my second career, right in the middle of my first career that hadn't really even started, essentially, was public education or informal education.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And when, like, is there a moment you think back on when you're like, oh, this is actually what I want to do?
Yeah, I think definitely working at Clooney was absolutely, like, reinforced it. But I think... if you think back to, like, the first thing or first memory of school and kind of, like, one of those field trips, like, what was one of those moments in school you're like, ah, yeah, this is awesome. Like, I love this.
That was what happened?
Yeah. Right. So it was, like, any of those moments where we had a field trip or, like,
you
know, something like outdoor school, something immersive, those have always stuck with me, and that's always been my favorite way to learn. So I was like, oh yeah, no, I do love that. Like, I love classroom teaching, but I love informal education so much more.
Is it like that moment when you see like a kid's eyes light up when they connect the dots on something?
Totally. Yeah, yeah. And it's those, the fact that you're kind of doing sneaky learning.
Mm.
So it's like kids are learning, but seeing just them come alive and really engage with education, that's what lights my fire.
That's awesome. Back to the actual archaeological mm-hmm. part of this, like what did you find in that, like, other than the teaching, but like the yeah. actual archaeological, I'll use my good English words here, did you find anything cool? Was that actual process of like getting in there and getting your hands dirty, like, did you enjoy that as well?
Oh yeah, no, I love it. If I ever end up going back to being a shovel bum, which is
that's the
colloquial term. folks who like basically do the excavation and solely do excavation is the shovel bumming. Yeah, I would absolutely go back in a heartbeat. But you find really cool things here, and because the timeline is so tight when you're excavating, if you're digging in 1 centimeter into the ground, you're digging into about 30 years of history. So every centimeter is about 30 years of history at this site.
Really?
Yeah, so you're working really, really fine with like toothbrushes, fine brushes, and doing really intricate trowel work, which is not the case for the most part when you're working pretty much anywhere else. You have sites that will use like full-on construction equipment to get into the ground before you'll be able to like really get in there with shovels. So it's a different way of working, but it's really great because it trains your eye really well.
Mm-hmm.
We'd find things like fish scales, beads, lots of bones, coyote, bison, some fish, but not really. Because fish was seen as kind of like a taboo food to eat, even though the river's right there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do we know why?
Not really, no. But we do know that it was not like the main fish, like it wasn't the main food source. It was one of those scarcity things, and same thing with like dogs. they obviously didn't want to eat them, but if it was a time of like scarcity and food shortage, they would.
Right.
So yeah, finding dog bones was kind of an indication that they were going through hard times, mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool from a evidence kind of point of view. But you'd find lots of other cool stuff. You find the evidence of fireplaces or hearths, fire broken rock, and all sorts of stuff.
How big of an area is this?
Oh, it's big.
Like a city block or like multiple city blocks?
Multiple city blocks. I'd probably say kilometer is probably the whole site.
Like a kilometer?
Yeah, probably a kilometer radius. It's pretty big.
Huh.
Yeah.
And there's just stuff everywhere.
Yeah. It's very awesome. Lots still to uncover.
And can you just go see this place?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Blackfoot Crossing Historical Park.
Huh.
Yep.
Who knew? Probably a lot of people, but I did not.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And the museum there is absolutely stunning, too. It's all run by the Siksika Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it is a stunning building. And yet, like I said, it just overlooks the spot where Treaty 7 was signed. And when you're there, when it's not the dig season, so in the summer, it probably won't look like much, honestly, because it gets filled in every single summer, every single field school.
It gets filled back in.
Yep.
How come?
Part of that is because of the training. So there's also the Indigenous Youth Engagement Program in there, too, which works with the Siksika High School to train them in archaeological techniques so they can be the ones taking their own history out of the ground. And part of that is learning how to get into a site. So they actually do the shovel work to dig back into the site. And then every single year, what they do is they put down landscaping cloth from where they finished. So one of the big parts about archaeology is you actually take a lot of notes and do a lot of paperwork.
Hence your notebook.
Yeah, I've always been a note taker.
I love also, just as a side quest, you're like taped in pictures and stuff.
Yeah,
I've never seen that.
Kind of use it as like a living scrapbook because I love scrapbooking, but I don't do it. I just don't do scrapbooking. So this is kind of like both my journal and like my scrapbook, my diary, my brain.
That's
essentially
everything Amy right there.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's super cool.
Yeah. What was I talking about?
The dig site,
right?
They fill it in.
Yeah. So they put down landscaping fabric to know where you stopped, and then also to protect any of the artifacts that were uncovered. They do their best, for sure, to try and get as much out of the ground as possible, but sometimes with time constraints, you can't get everything out that you want to. So sometimes what they'll do is just photograph it and come back to it next year. Because in theory, it's not going anywhere.
I mean, it's been there for hundreds?
Hundreds of years, if
hundreds,
not thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool.
Isn't that delightful? There's a nice little picture of a flower over here.
Yeah,
people are so creative.
Yeah, speaking of creativity,
yes.
My second kind of job as I was transitioning out of archaeology was working at the Telspark Science Center.
I saw that on your LinkedIn.
Yeah, so I worked there for 5 years.
Yeah.
And did all sorts of things. So I started actually as a facilitator when the Star Trek exhibit came through.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was how I started there.
So the I can't even do the thing.
The Vulcan salute. Absolutely. Live long and prosper.
I can't really. I'm more of a Star Wars.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I grew up with both.
You lean towards the Trek?
I don't know. That's a divisive subject.
That's a whole podcast.
I don't know. I like both for different reasons.
Okay. Yeah. I respect it.
Yep.
I respect it. I only like Star Wars, but that's
fair. I also respect that. So I started there, and then I kind of worked my way up, had different roles, and eventually found my way into the position of being the science school coordinator for the Open Mind Science, Open Minds program, Campus mm-hmm. Calgary Open Minds. There we go. I got it.
So you like always find your way back to teaching or like educating in some way?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was really cool to finally be in that position. And basically it's like a year-long kind of thing that schools can apply for. And they have a guiding question, which is really interesting. So instead of having a strict curriculum to follow, they basically base all of their learning around that question for the year. Mm. And then at some point in that year, they go to a site somewhere in Calgary to have a week-long experience at that site. So, like, Science School is the second oldest site. Zoo School was the original site in Calgary. And then the Glenbow Museum was the second one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like you're my new go-to for Calgary-related historical facts.
I've got a lot in my brain, that's for sure.
Yeah. When it comes to science, mm-hmm. my head goes to very fact-based, very math-based, very logical-based. But off the top, you said creativity. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm wondering, where is the intersection between science and creativity that you've learned or seen with your experience?
I think it's honestly there the entire time, because when it comes to science and exploring all that exists and what is covered under that umbrella, you kind of need a different type of perspective to look at it and creatively think around it. For instance, a lot of people talk about STEM versus STEAM, and I don't think you can have STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math, without A, so the arts piece. And when people ask me about this, a lot of the time I kind of direct them to the arts, and specifically theater, mm-hmm. because you have so much science in theater, and especially things like, I don't know, like lighting and photography and cinematography.
Even music is very, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Like, you have all these amazing things that exist in the film industry. Without science, you wouldn't have them, but without art, you wouldn't have them either, because you have the science behind the tool they're using, and then you have the creative brain that is behind the tool, the person who uses the tool.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I don't think you can have art without science, and vice versa.
Agreed. Do you believe in magic?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You didn't even hesitate on that.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely. Like, I don't think there's so many things in this world we can't explain yet through a science lens. But also, it's like, where's the joy in life if you don't have a little bit of things that you can't explain? Or, like,
yeah,
like, I think sunsets are magical. They're also scientific, but they're magical.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, I think if you're not able to believe or kind of suspend reality for a little bit, then you also kind of close yourself off a little bit for creativity and innovation and imagining what is possible. Mm-hmm. Because one of my favorite things about my work with Spark was I also got to do not this current year, so it'd have been 2021, 2022 Spark After Dark. Yeah, that series of those Spark After Darks, so the adult only nights. And I always started with a sense of how can we get adults to play? Because there's so many times that adults aren't given permission to play, and I think at some point in time we lose or give ourselves permission to do that. And I think it's so important, because if you think about it, as kids, we so often learn through play. And if you look at the animal kingdom, so many animals learn through play, like foxes and chimpanzees. Even if you look at cats or puppies playing in, like, the dog park, you really can't find a lot of lessons in life without that base of play first. So it's like, why don't we allow ourselves to learn more about ourselves as adults through play? And I think a lot of times we're only given that sense of, like, yeah, you can go play if you have kids, and I think that's such a shame.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's giving yourselves more opportunity to play.
And how have you found success, or did you find success, I guess, in getting people open to that?
You know, it's funny. It doesn't take much.
No?
No. It's like, as soon as you remove the barriers or just, like, openly have activities going, adults are often pretty okay with doing those. The ones that are always take a little bit more convincing are ones that require a little bit of bravery or courage. Mm-hmm. So things like improv or bringing people up on stage to, say, light their hand on fire in a safe way that's not going to hurt them. like, it's those ones that always take a little bit more of a push and pull, but those are also the ones where people tend to get the most out of the experience too.
Interesting. What did you learn about creativity for yourself in that time?
Mm. I think I learned that not everyone's sense of creativity is the same. Mm. So what some people may find a creative outlet, others may not.
Right.
And also that there's a lot of a preconceived notion that you have to be good at something to be creative, rather than just the process and working through the process of something. Like learning how to play guitar, a lot of people are like, if I'm not good at it, I'm not going to do it. Where it's like you could just like take that sense of learning how to do something as a hobby versus like, I don't know, learning how to play Devil Went Down to Georgia and succeeding.
Do you know what your creative process kind of is at this point?
Mm-hmm. A lot of times I go out in nature and just like see where the inspiration from nature takes me. But I do find that I need to like remove myself from technology first to be able to like kind of have that lack of distraction and sense of like urgency to reply to people if they're texting me or anything like that. So yeah, usually removing myself from distractions first and then just allowing myself to be and see where my brain takes me.
Just to be.
Mm-hmm. I know you can't take it. Like, you can't force it. That's the big thing, is you can't will your brain to think of something if you're stuck. I've tried, and it doesn't work that well.
How do you know when you're, like, in that state of being, flow state? There's lots of words for it, but, like, I think one thing that's hard for a lot of people is to know when they're there.
Yeah. It's weird, but I don't think I know I'm there until I come out of it, if that makes sense.
It does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and most of the time it's because I look down at my watch and realize an hour has passed by, and I'm like, oh, look at that.
Time flew.
Yeah.
When was the last time that happened to you that you recall?
It would probably be last week when I was working on my talk for Pachakacha, which I gave last week.
What was that?
Yeah, so Pachakacha is a really cool kind of, I would say movement, I guess, kind of movement sort of thing, where it's a global thing. You're given 20 slides, and each of those slides you have 20 seconds to speak on. So you're given 400 seconds of time to speak on any subject that is around the theme for the night.
Which was?
Last week's theme was The Living City.
And is this like an ongoing thing, or is this like a one?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So last week's was number 43 or 42. So.
And where does this happen?
All over the city.
Really?
Yeah. Happens on a yearly basis usually.
Yeah.
And you can like nominate anyone in the city to go and speak and try and convince them to do it. And I think this is the first time I spoke, and it was pretty fun actually. So yeah, I think last week was the last time I found myself in that flow state, because I was, you know, planning it and thinking about what I wanted to say. But
what'd you speak on? Like,
yeah, that was fun. I actually talked about, because the theme was Living City, I kind of talked about how museums, and artifacts have their own life, and how museums kind of need to start approaching themselves in a new way, which is not an uncommon or new thought by any means. There's a lot of talk in museums and the cultural industry and around decolonization, reconciliation, but also what museums look like going forward to the future, and kind of the new life that... How do museums reflect the lives of the cities that they're in as well, and current culture versus only focusing on the past?
Right. That sounds like a difficult needle to kind of thread.
Totally, yeah, because naturally we know in museums, like you have the British Museum, for instance, of natural history, and so much of those artifacts are stolen or not patriated appropriately and haven't been returned or refused to be returned. So it's how do you develop those relationships? Again, it all goes back to relationships. It's like, how do you do good now that you've got all these artifacts just sitting somewhere, being quote-unquote preserved, but why does that matter if they aren't back with people who they belong to or the culture they belong to? So yeah, they take on a different life when they leave.
How did you, I guess, what have you what is the work you've done in the reconciliation area, and how did you kind of end up going down that path?
Yeah, that's one thing that I think I've always been passionate about. So I had my undergrad, two undergrads, one in archaeology and one in anthropology. And I went into anthropology because I've always been fascinated by, like, other cultures and learning about just how people all across the globe live their lives. But I also vividly remember always being interested in the First Nations units whenever I was in school. Like, that was always so fascinating to me, and how we learned about people who still exist but always talked about them as if they didn't.
Yeah.
So that kind of led me more so when we were talking about archaeology and then talking about digging up past in Alberta. And it's like, well, why don't we have, like, Indigenous people digging up their own history? So that's kind of where my brain first started. And then when the TRC's Call to Actions came out in 2015,
yeah.
And reading all those findings, that was when I was like, okay, I got to do something. I am, like, a white settler woman. I got to do something.
Yeah.
So I actually went into grad school, and my first year was all in Indigenous education. And that was in pursuit of my master's in education.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have your master's?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah. I fully finished it and graduated last year, November.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do not recommend going into grad school during a global pandemic, learning it all online while also planning a wedding. I don't recommend that.
Those all converge together for some purpose, I guess.
Yeah. But there's a lot of room for a lot of work and a lot of conversations. And again, it's the truth has to come before the reconciliation, and we still have a lot of truth telling yet to do and a lot of relationships to repair before we can really move forward.
Do you think those relationships are repairable?
I think it's a very tough question to ask, and it's very person-to-person based too, because
yeah.
I think in some ways there are relationships that are able to be repaired, but there's also a lot of trauma there and a lot of intergenerational trauma that's going to be harder to explain, harder to address, and harder to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
And some people may never want to, and that's okay too, because it's their experiences, their journeys. But ultimately, as, like, a nation, as a city, I think it's really important to do what you can to reconcile and figure out how your own history and your own family's history intersects with the history of Canada and Indigenous people.
Yeah, I gotta go back to it and finish it, but I did start that course that the U of A was offering for free.
Oh, awesome one.
Yeah, I got, like, halfway through it. And as I do, got distracted by something else, but I found it very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that I never really wrapped my head around that, you know, I'm remembering right now is just, it was like hundreds of years, like a long time where, you know, settlers and Indigenous people basically cohabitated.
Mm-hmm.
Or cohabited? Anyway, we were all here, and I'm not saying it was all equal, but whatever, but like, then there's like this point where residential schools and all that came in, but like there's like a lot of history before that.
Yeah.
That's just like, I don't ever remember hearing about, learning about, being told about. It's just, I don't know, it was just interesting to kind of see, like, there's just a lot more history there than maybe you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where a lot of that truth telling needs to happen, right? Is because there's a lot of history missing that we did not learn as kids, and definitely it's mandated in the curriculum. It's mandated as what teachers have to teach Indigenous history. It's one of the teaching quality standards.
Now?
Yeah. And it has been for 8 years at least,
okay.
If not a full decade.
Isn't that crazy? Like,
yep.
Only... Anyway, yeah.
I know. It's truly bananas, but it's also the importance of giving educators the tools to be able to teach that.
Mm-hmm.
And educators have been just truly walloped with the amount of expectations and amount of roles that they're expected to take on, and, especially, again, in the past decade or 15 years.
Well, I can imagine, like, you teach one thing for 20 years, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now now you've got to go not only teach this, but go learn it.
Mm-hmm. And, like, that is one of the responsibilities of being an educator. But on top of that, you've got folks who are expected to be psychologists, nurses, caretakers. Like, you just, there's so many jobs on top of being a teacher that you have folks dealing with all these things and then having their tools and the funding for those tools just be removed year after year after year after year. And just, it's so hard for educators right now, and we really saw that during the pandemic. But I think it's important to really remember how important and vital teachers really are to our society.
What's your take on maybe like the modern student?
Mm-hmm.
Are they as, I mean, there's probably a perception like, well, Gen Z and then whatever's after Gen Z, I don't even know, sort of entitled, think they know everything, like it's sort of the rap they have.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience though, I guess, in working with them? What are maybe some of the good things or the superpowers that maybe you see in this next generation?
Yeah, I think they've been honestly dealt a pretty crappy set of cards, because like I said, they lost 3 years of essentially development in a classroom, and those are really key years. It doesn't really matter where you're looking in the K-12 spectrum. At some point, those are 3 years that students didn't have. So they had 3 years of potentially no field trips. They had 3 years of no relationship developing face-to-face. They really lost a sense of like facial recognition and how to read body language and emotional intelligence, which is huge and massive to develop. And then if you're talking about high school and junior high, they really lost a lot of their social networks and how to develop good relationships. So you're approaching a completely different set of behaviors, of mindsets, and you're also looking at students who are realizing that, and even with my own generation, so millennials, you're looking at students who are facing the world who may have been told a lot of things by their parents, like if you go to school and you get a job, then you'll be fine, you'll be able to afford a house, you can have kids. But that's not true anymore. and it's for reasons that are completely out of their control. Like even myself, like I've got 2 bachelor's degrees and a master's degree, and it's like, I can't afford a house. Absolutely not. And it's like kind of choosing between.
And this is one of the most affordable places in Canada for a big city, which is crazy.
Yeah, and we're pretty not affordable.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that the new housing strategy passed, honestly, this past week, but there just needs to be more done. Like, yeah. Rent control from our provincial government would be great. That's a big step, but coming back. I think that it's just a lot, because of all the change that these kids are experiencing and have experienced, they are so resilient and so adaptable. And they also, even though their like attention spans might be shorter, they also know how to utilize tools in a completely different way than we ever would have thought. For instance, AI is a really hilarious thing that is so useful and can be used to like start a paper or used to like help provide essentially building blocks for a lot of things. Or it can be used to plagiarize an entire paper.
Potato, potato? Yeah.
Exactly. So it's kind of like learning to work with the tools that you have rather than just outright rejecting them. Mm-hmm. To be able to reach students at a different level. Or like, for instance, I don't know, have a TikTok assignment, for instance, and have students build a TikTok series around a certain education topic. Like, there's the amount of information that is out there is amazing, and it's just the way that we have to teach students is like, how do you approach those tools and how do you use those tools responsibly in the realm of education? Because just saying outright that they don't exist, that's not going to help anybody.
Yeah, so many different mediums to receive information, so many different mediums to express information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of growing up, like, you're pretty boxed in, write this way because I said so, whereas like now there's so many ways you could show somebody's intellect or genius, you know, not through just writing on a piece of paper, but like there's so many tools now.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that would be overwhelming for educators though, because like, where's the line? And like, how many things do you need to know to like properly assess someone's understanding of a topic. It's fascinating. Like, I don't really think about it often, but as we kind of jam on it, it's like it could be a very, it could be very hard to get your arms around it if you're an educator.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of those things I'm talking about is like, so not only are educators expected to educate your children, they are also expected to know everything under the sun about whatever they're teaching, which, you know, is constantly changing. And that's great, because that's one of the beautiful things about education is we are constantly having to change perspectives or take in new information, which can then inform our ideas about the world. So it's kind of like also making sure that educators are teaching students not what to think, but how to think, and how to look at their information they're receiving critically. And that's a big piece that is a shift in terms of the world of education, but it's also been a shift, unfortunately, going backwards with the new curriculum that has been implemented, versus the other draft curriculum, which was going to be coming out before the change in government.
Right. And I probably should be more educated on this than I am, but my understanding is that the new curriculum borrows a lot from the old curriculum and is very, not very modern.
It's in terms of pedagogy, it's going backwards. It's going to like the 80s and before then in terms of pedagogy, which is not a great way to approach how we're teaching students. It's a lot more rhetoric, a lot more rote memorization, which again, facts are facts. You can learn those on the internet. We have so many tools. We can always learn facts, but if you're not teaching students how to approach ways of thinking, how to approach an argument, how to approach having a conversation, then having those skills to be able to have a conversation with someone who disagrees with you or doesn't have the same worldviews, that's what I honestly think is a lot of the reason we're seeing so many stressors come to the forefront is because we're not able to have those conversations and everything's just like a tinderbox.
Yeah.
It's just exhausting.
Swipe left. Interesting. I reminds me of a conversation I had with my son the other night.
Mm-hmm.
He has to do a TED Talk style assignment.
Great.
On gun violence.
Ooh, you said he's 12?
Yeah, he's in grade 7.
Oh, my.
And they had a variety of topics, and I don't know if he picked it or it got picked to him, whatever, but his topic is gun violence. And so his assertion or hypothesis was gun violence, there's more gun violence because of easy accessibility to guns.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, sure. How do you know that? How can you prove that? Like, what?
Right.
How do you... And so basically we went down a rabbit hole of talking about correlation versus causation.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with this example. Like, you could buy a clock and then wake up at 6 in the morning, and you might assume that the clock is the thing that woke you up, but we didn't actually say that the clock had an alarm on it or that we set an alarm.
Mm-hmm.
You bought a clock and you woke up. There's a correlation, or you woke up earlier. Anyways, we start talking about that with guns. Like, just because someone has access to a gun doesn't mean that's who pulled the trigger. So, like, how do you actually connect those with proof?
Yep.
Or at least, like, something reasonable that you can make an argument on.
Totally.
And it didn't seem like, and it's not, it didn't seem like that conversation had, if it had happened, it hadn't landed. It was just like, these two things make sense, and I mean, logically they do. But, like, that next level of, like, critical thinking, that's going to apply to, like, everything in life. And so, anyway, that's what I want to see him get to, is, like, getting a little deeper on that.
Totally. And, like, that's my jam. I love having those deep conversations and those getting people to think critically. And it's so important just because, again, we have so many ways and so many avenues of getting knowledge that it's really analyzing how are we actually thinking about how that knowledge applies to our lives, our worldviews, our ideologies that matters. Because, you can look up how to do things on Wikipedia. You can go to WikiHow and learn how to do, like, YouTube. There's
sure.
just there's so many avenues of education. It's really just finding what matters to you. Why does it matter to you, and how do you apply that education to the world and what you're going to do in it? Because it's not what you're going to do with your life, it's what are you going to do within your life, right?
Mm. Well, in an era of so much information, how do you make that useful? And I don't think that's just a student kid problem. This is like workplace adults, like stats for the or facts for the sake of it. Like, okay, cool. How do you make that useful?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do with that information?
Mm-hmm. And even more important, what is useful? What does that
what
mean?
What is useful? Yeah. Like,
what's useful to one person is completely just not relevant to another. So it's like kind of that STEM and that big question of education is how do you actually make something matter to your students? Mm-hmm. And the reality is it's not going to matter to every student. And when you accept that, you got to figure out then those touch points to make it matter to every student. And that gets harder and harder the more students you have in your class, the more individuals you're working with, and the more challenges that each individual student has. So that's also one of those giant, giant responsibilities of educators is how do you tailor education to every student? Because you can't. Exactly. You don't have the resources. You don't have the time.
And even that approach is probably setting yourself up for failure. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, most, I think in most anything, whatever you're doing, 30% of people might, if you're lucky, care.
Yeah.
30% are probably going to be opposed and 30% are going to be like neutral. So like if you can shift the balance to the left a little bit through engaging content and mm-hmm. inclusivity and all those things, that's great. But you almost have to be realistic right out of the gate. You're never going to get everybody.
Yeah. And that actually goes back to my work at Spark, was finding ways to engage everyone, even if they didn't take that information with them at the end of the day.
Right.
So it's like, did they have a memorable experience? Whether it's something that made them uncomfortable, something that made them think, something that just was a riot and had just gave them so much fun and joy, or maybe just got them to stop and pause. Like, what kind of experience do we want people to have? And that's more what we would tailor it for than the actual information itself. Because, again, you can find information anywhere. It's how you're conveying that information to get it really to stick in people's brains.
One thing you said earlier that is surfacing up for me again, too, is you were talking about how you like the hands-on education versus the, like, in-class, which is interesting to me because you have the two undergrads and a master's. So you've been in the classroom.
And then some.
I have one semester of general studies. After high school, and that's it.
Yep.
So I went the other way, all hands-on, I've taken some courses along the way. What do you like about the hands-on, real-world learning versus the curriculum-based?
Mm-hmm. I find that when you have those hands-on experiences, you just get more buy-in from the get-go. Even if people know that what they're entering into is like an educational experience, again, if they're having fun, then that's all that matters to me at the end of the day. Is like, did you have fun? Did you enjoy yourself? And like, if you didn't learn anything subject-wise, what did you learn about yourself?
Which is often like where most follow-through/inspiration occurs anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Because I don't know anyone who's ever gotten inspiration from a worksheet, personally. Yeah.
Oh, I still have anxiety about Mad Minutes. Does that count?
Oh, yeah. I know. I actually do have, like, math PTSD from my elementary school teacher. Yeah, math and I are not friends.
It's so funny because, like, when I look back on it, if math could have been formatted into baseball and hockey...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm really good at that math.
Yeah, and well, that's the thing. So I actually designed an entire week around math for a school, for like a grade 2 week that we had. And I can't remember what their big question was, but I want to say it was like, how do we see numbers in the world or something? Or like, how do we experience the world through data, which is also like a really cool field. One of the ways that I loved learning about how to view math was actually from one of my coworkers, Corey Chewy, who did her PhD in ethnomathematics. So how different cultures learn math.
Okay.
Which is really cool.
That sounds interesting.
Very interesting. And that goes back to kind of those earlier conversations about significance of like numbers in indigenous cultures. So you have things like fours, where it's like four cycles of life, four chunks of the medicine wheel, four sacred medicines, like the
it's
number
funny,
repeats.
Four, that's my jam.
There you go, yeah. Right? Like it's really cool. So like not only learning numbers and the significance in terms of like cultural stories, and just like the meaning behind numbers, but also learning them in different ways. So for instance, there's an amazing author, Juliet Robinson, who has this book called Messy Maths. And there's things like pattern recognition and statistics and learning all those things through interacting with nature. And I was like, if I had learned math through nature, like I'm a nature nut to begin with, I would have been so much happier. Because, you know, those like all of my math lessons I hated, I dreaded, I just had nightmares about math. But if I had learned them through tactile things, through like counting and looking through patterns and numbers in nature, like I just would have done so much better. I would have been so much happier.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
That
occurred to me. My son was doing a project last year on weather patterns in Yellowknife.
Oh, yeah.
And I was bored listening to him explaining whatever he was talking about. He was bored. Everyone was bored. But like an hour later, he's telling you about Fortnite, Lazy Lake, this, da 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 da. I'm like, if you took that exact same information and just applied it to Fortnite, like there should be a Fortnite Academy, and like he would have known it, like, and then some.
I know. I mean, that's the reason why Minecraft created their education sector. Like, there's an entire amazing set of lessons created in Minecraft for students, and there's things on like pollinators and bees. There's like full-on math lessons about the elements, about geography. Like, again, if you are making things that are exciting for students to learn and making it, that's their first entry point, is something they're already excited about. That's what we call inquiry-based education. So if you have students who are focused on a question that they want to seek an answer to, they're going to want to learn more versus here's a math worksheet, now learn your timetables.
Totally.
So yeah, informal education has always been my jam, for sure.
I dig it. Have you done any curriculum design or things like that?
Yeah, so my second year of my graduate studies was all in curriculum design. The entire year-long program was called Curriculum and Divergence, which was so cool. So I looked at like social justice and equity through the lens of curriculum, and then also looked at it through land-based education. So again, huge nature nut, so that was a great semester for me. So it's really interesting. I'm actually going through right now, the Alberta government is seeking public response to their draft curriculum. So I've been working through that and providing my feedback, which has been
interesting.
Very interesting, because they are calling for feedback, but not to the same extent that the previous curriculum was developed under and called for feedback. Like, there was a whole basically 2-year process of asking educators, organizations that work with education, teachers actively teaching,
and then they just pedagogical the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. So they had a longer process, but this is still at least some level of engagement, which is nice, rather than the previous part of the curriculum, which they pretty much released with no consultation, which is very frustrating.
Right. Do you dabble at all in curriculum creation? Is that
a little bit? Yeah. My entire summer was actually spent. Well, not my entire summer, but a large part of my summer in my work was making curriculum connections for environmental education and climate education in the high school curriculums. So English language arts, biology, chemistry, and social studies was where we were focusing on for the summer. So now we're going through that process of, speaking of consultation, grabbing some educators and indigenous curriculum consultants and working through that process to make sure we got it right.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Do you want to know the purpose of my asking those
questions?
Sure,
I would love.
So I just took on a role as executive director of a charity called Empowering Artists. And our goal is to help, we have a few goals, but where we're going to focus to start is supporting entrepreneurial Canadian musicians.
Cool.
I've learned some really interesting facts about arts and culture, but specifically when it comes to like artists as a profession.
Mm-hmm.
52% of artists are self-employed.
Yeah.
Versus 12% of the greater population. So it's just like way over-indexed.
Yeah.
And the majority, I want to say the majority, might have been in the 40%, so maybe not quite the majority, but over 40% of artists have degrees. So it's a very educated group of people.
Yep.
But yet their gross income is significantly lower, almost entirely, not entirely, over half self-employed,
mm-hmm.
and very little in the ecosystem in terms of like entrepreneur support.
Mm-hmm.
And career development.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we're creating, and we're working with some artists right now, and we want to pull in some educators in that, is the Entrepreneurial Artist Program.
Right, okay.
And so there was some recommendations that came out of something called the West Anthem Report, where they looked at the whole music industry, specifically in Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the recommendations that came out, was the development of like a 12-month career development entrepreneurial program for
mm-hmm.
artists. There was also some really good recommendations around Indigenous programming.
Right.
That happened in 2020. They just did their follow-up in 2023.
Yeah.
And essentially nothing has happened in those buckets.
That does not shock me.
So, I mean, those are some areas that we want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know. Maybe there's some synergy to collaborate at some point.
For sure. And especially because if you think about the pandemic, how many of us turned to, like, art to get through it?
Everybody was painting and baking sourdough. I mean, maybe that's not an art, but like everybody was
oh, it's definitely an art. I don't know if you've ever been a baker, but like baking is artistry, and if not, it's magic.
Okay, magic.
That is maybe one of those things, hopes, prayers, and magic. And a lot of science actually in baking too, but it's truly wild because it's like the value we place on a society in certain industries over others. And then you think back again to that, the acronym of STEAM, and how much of the art is involved in all those things. And that's one of the reasons I went to school and to make a difference in our curriculum, was to make sure we have far more engagement with how we actually go through life and learn through life, which is interdisciplinary. We don't learn in buckets of math, English, social studies. That's not actually how we learn. We learn with everything intersecting all around us all the time.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do we bring that into the curriculum and make it a modern curriculum while still making sure that students have the skills they need to go through life? So it's like, how do we make sure that students are prepared financially? Because that's completely shifted, right? Like, if you don't have a family member or a friend who's involved in banking or in financials in some way, shape, or form, you likely didn't get a financial education.
Right.
Just
passed on your parents' proficiency or inefficiency.
Or inefficiency,
or anxiety,
exactly.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah, or you self-teach yourself, sure. And that's really scary, too.
Trial by error.
Exactly. So there's a lot of skills that are important to teach that we don't seem to value within the curriculum context, or are just ignored by whichever political party is in power.
Yeah, and I guess the way I see it, like, I'm very much on the page. How we deliver the information and how we engage people has to be community focused. It has to be hands on.
Yep.
It has to be interesting.
Yep.
There has to be credibility. I don't see it as a, you know, go sit in a classroom and get talked at type situation. We might do, you know, events where we have a really educated speaker on a topic, mm-hmm. but it's more like a round table or a panel type thing.
Yep.
So I guess I have a vision for what it will look like and how it'll work, but I think it needs to have a good backbone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where like having a solid curriculum and like an understanding of the how it's all going to kind of come together, or mm-hmm. at least like, you know, a module. I don't know. Like, that's not my expertise
totally.
Per se, but I just think the whole thing's got to have a backbone, and there's so much information out there. How do we kind of curate it to this use case that will be meaningful and helpful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of knowledge within that, right? Like, you want to make sure that artists are supported financially, because like you said, there's so many that are self-employed, which is not shocking to me, but it's still just like, how do we not value art more in our society? And because art was always, it's always been valued. You look across cultures across the world, and art is always something that's valued. You've got, like, for instance, the cave paintings. That's one of the first signs of human art.
And we do value it in the sense, like, the art industry in Alberta alone, based on this report, was $1.7 billion.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, the money's going there.
Yeah.
But it's not being circulated or distributed or balanced in anything resembling something that would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of that is coming from grants and from these artists having to take time to apply for those things and get those grants versus, like, I don't know, a universal, like, basic income, something like that.
I mean, that could be a whole another, we could have a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. Again, intersectionality. You've got these things happening throughout everything that exists in the world, but it's amazing truly to me. And there was also a huge significance or a huge decrease in, like, funding for the arts in the past 5 years too, which, like, you look at from when I was involved in the museum industry especially, like, a lot of funding goes to make sure that you have funding to make sure your museum is alive and thriving.
Yeah.
So when you have things that are reduced in funding, like culture, then it also kind of reflects on where your society's at too, which is a little scary.
And I think based on a lot of the stats, I've been, like, in research mode lately, I think culture is, like, a little, like, step above arts just in terms of, like, average income and things like that, but it's still not, you know, it's nowhere near some of the other things.
Well, and it's wild too, because, like, if you look at how people are funded or how institutions are funded in the States versus Canada, a lot of things in the States, like the positions and stuff, are contract-based, are funding-based, are just not secure. So if you're working in museums in the States, you are always in a state of flux pretty much, unless you find a salaried position, which are very hard to come by.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh my goodness, like, you just have these people who are really entering these industries for passion. And then you have it intersect with the fact that you can't pay your bills with passion, unfortunately. And that's the same issue that artists are facing. It's like, you can't pay your bills with passion, even though what your life's passion is completely valid, viable, and something that humanity needs.
Well, I learned, actually. Have you ever heard of Bill 75?
Yeah.
I want to know more about, like, the specifics of it, but there's actually legislation that was passed that basically, you know, calls out the fact that being an artist is a profession and equal pay and treatment.
Yep.
It's kind of crazy that that required a legislation to be passed, but, like, I don't think most artists or purveyors of talent in that space even know that that exists, let alone are leveraging it.
Yeah, it's truly wild. I have a lot of friends who are artists and are involved in some sort of creative pursuit, or that's their career, and it's really wild to me that they can't make a living with something that they are well skilled at, have dedicated their lives to, or have gone to advanced education and pursued. And funny enough, I was at a housing conversation last night, and a lot of these same topics came up. It's like, no matter what industry, what degree you're pursuing, you should be able to, especially with, like, an advanced degree, you should be able to make a living off of that. And the fact that we have so many people who are have master's or PhDs and are, like, back at home living with their parents or living rough or living unsecured or unstable housing is absolutely wild.
And if they were able to do that, do what they're great at, do what they're trained for, like, there's no way it's not making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. It's completely different, and it's also a really great way to reflect what's happening in the world, and kind of circling back to how I found myself here, it's another lens we can look at to solve, like, the big questions of the world, like the climate crisis, is like, well, what are the emotions that make you feel? Because if you don't address those, how are you going to work through those emotions to be able to try and figure out, well, how do I make myself not feel this way or continue to feel this way if it's a good feeling? But it's like also the perspectives you need to understand what everyone's going through to be able to understand the full scope of an issue. So you need to understand the intersectionality of where we are, you need to understand the issues that everyone's facing in their own perspectives, so you can try and find, come to the table and find a good solution together. So whether that's through activism, through art, or through a scientist working at a university and using invasive species to help decrease nitrogen levels, like,
That is still a cool story. I like
so
that.
So cool. Yeah. I know, right? But it's just like, again, that intersectionality is there's all these people working towards the common goal, hopefully, of living together cohesively on this planet. So it's just having those conversations with different people, different perspectives, different talents, and then figuring out how to work together.
One chunk at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed our chat today. I have a haircut, so I do gotta run.
Just one hair.
One hair.
One just, hair. Yep.
And that'll
okay.
be good.
Quick appointment.
Yeah. One last question for you.
Yeah.
What's your favorite song to sing along to?
Ooh. Favorite song to sing along to?
A hard hitting question
it
for
is.
Last. I love how, like, some people, it's like, boom. And then other people, it's like a whole thing.
Oh, my gosh. It's a Red Hot Chili Peppers song.
Scar Tissue?
No.
Under the Bridge?
No. It's the
Californication.
Thank you.
There you go.
Yeah, Californication.
That's a good one. Okay. You're the first person to actually, like, start singing along on the pod. So,
oh,
like,
well, there you go. Yeah. fun fact is that I used to do princess gigs as one of my many, many jobs. So I used to do dress up as Disney princesses and go to parties and parades and such. So
what was your go-to princess?
Usually Rapunzel or Cinderella.
Okay.
Yeah, depending on the request. But, yeah.
There you go.
Yep.
That is, you... Many hats.
One could say I've gone through all the disciplines, if you will. But yes, many, many hats, many, many jobs.
This was awesome. Thank you so much, Amy.
You're welcome.
Okay.